2002 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents session number 132, a discussion reviewing the book Nauvoo, A Place of Peace, A People of Promise, featuring Devery S. Anderson, Gary James Bergera, H. Michael Marquardt, and William D. Russell. Okay, we'll go ahead and start. This is session 132, Nauvoo, A Place of Peace, A People of Promise, a panel discussion on the new book by Glenn Leonard. My name is Devery Anderson, and I am moderating this session. I'll introduce our panelists. We'll be here, and this is the order we'll be listening to them to. We have Gary James Bergera, who will be first. He is the managing director of the Smith Pettit Foundation, and for several years was also director of publishing at Signature Books. Next we'll have H. Michael Marquardt, who's an author. He's put together two books for Signature Books. One is with Wesley P. Walters, Inventing Mormonism, Tradition and the Historical Record, and his latest is the Joseph Smith Revelations, a text and commentary. Then we'll hear from William D. Russell, who is professor of American history at Graceland University, and also the author of a forthcoming book on RLDS fundamentalist schism, and another book on the 1989 Colt murders in Kirtland, Ohio. I'll take just a second here to get the ball rolling and introduce the book a little bit. In 1972, when church historian Leonard Arrington announced his project to produce a 16-volume History of the Church to appear by the 1980 LDS sesquicentennial, history lovers throughout the church were quite excited. I was, and I was only 12 at the time. So my love of history goes back quite a ways. The project was to be scholarly. Each volume would be produced by an individual historian with expertise in the area or time period assigned. And because each volume was produced by 16 different authors total, they were expected to be thorough in their research and groundbreaking in their interpretations. And with 8 years ahead of them, they had plenty of time to do it. But most of us know that this project was abandoned early on, and the authors were paid for the research they had done, and they were let out of their contracts with Deseret Book. But any future work on the projects would be done independently of the original vision, and some authors pressed on from there. We're aware of some of these books that had come out, that have come out since. The first in 1983 was Milton Bachman's The Heavens Resound, followed in 1984 by Richard Bushman's book Joseph Smith and the Beginnings of Mormonism. Richard O'Callaghan, who had been assigned the early 20th century, I believe, period, expanded his project to take it up through the 20th century up until the 1985 when the book was published. In 1986, Mormonism in Transition came about by Thomas Alexander, followed by Establishing Zion by Eugene Campbell in 1988, as well as a few books on the International Church, as Lamont Tullis's Mormons in Mexico, as well as, I can't remember the author now, Unto the Isles of the Sea, Lanier Bridge, is that right? Yes, produced that book. But I think everybody, at least speaking for myself and others, I think the one we were anxious for was the book on Nauvoo, which had been served as LDS Church headquarters from 1839 to 1846. Now, this book had been originally assigned to historian T. Edgar Lyon in 1972, and the project was then turned over to Glenn Leonard, who started working with Lyon before Lyon's death, but when Lyon died in 1978, Leonard took the project over. So whether we look at this book as 30 years in the making, dating back to 1972, or 24 years in the making, dating to when Glenn Leonard took it over, it's interesting to ponder the fact that the Nauvoo could have risen and fallen 3 to 4 times in the time it took to produce the definitive history. So knowing that, history buffs who are aware of that and who've been waiting for this for a long time now have this 828-page book to devour. And as you mentioned, it is called Nauvoo, A Place of Peace, A People of Promise, and it came out this year, in May of 2002. Now, Mormons have always been fascinated by Nauvoo, and I suppose there are many reasons for that. Each individual Mormon could probably tell you a different reason, but some of them are because of its history. Its location is a river town on the bank of the Mississippi. The Nauvoo Restoration Project that has grown over the years and attracted so many tourists who have come to know Nauvoo for that reason. The doctrinal developments and experiments of the period, which have fascinated scholars and history buffs, and the fact that it was the end of the Joseph Smith era and the physical reminder of having Carthage Jail nearby. Because of that fascination, the gasps heard around the church when President Gordon B. Hinckley announced that the Nauvoo Temple would be rebuilt, I think would have only been surpassed by that announcement been made that there was a temple coming in Independence, Missouri. But that one didn't come, thank goodness, because in Mormon minds, the temple in Independence means the end of the world, the coming of Christ, and a whole lot of drama to follow. Nauvoo, on the other hand, despite the unhappy ending, there's something happy about it for Mormons that we're nostalgic, and I think having the temple back there, which serves only a handful of saints, really, compared to the other hundred and some temples, I think we look at that as a happy time. We have Nauvoo back, and that's represented by having that temple back on the bluff again, looking over the Mississippi as it did in 1846. So now just a few general comments from me about the book, and then I'll turn this over to the panelists. I'm probably going to raise more questions here that I'm hoping that they will really talk about. But when I bought the book, the very first thing I did was look at the bibliography. Knowing that Glenn Leonard had co-authored the book Story of the Latter-day Saints, knowing that the authors got into a little trouble with Ezra Taft Benson over that one originally for some of their interpretations and being candid in a few areas, when that book was a second edition came out in 1992, I was happy to see references to Michael Quinn's Early Mormonism and Magic Worldview, David Berger's articles on the Temple Endowment, and all of that, which surprised but pleased me. And so I consulted the bibliography of this book first off, was surprised and puzzled and disappointed. I was happy to see three essays by D. Michael Quinn cited. George Smith's Nauvoo Roots of Mormon Polygamy and Todd Compton's In Sacred Loneliness were all there. I wasn't surprised, but disappointed nevertheless, that none of Quinn's books were listed, nor was Richard Van Wagner's book Mormon Polygamy, A History, cited. Neither was his essay Mormon Polyandry in Nauvoo, which had been published in Dialogue in the 80s. Now, can a book that's, I don't know whether Glenn Leonard would call this the definitive book. He may hope others would refer to it as that or see it as that, the definitive work on Nauvoo. But can a book that is not cite these works? Were they not groundbreaking enough? Is the information that they contain cited elsewhere, and so was the material covered? That's what I wanted to find out by reading the book. It's clear that Leonard is a true historian by placing Nauvoo in its 19th century American context. For example, some background to the emerging industrial age helps us understand the limitations of Nauvoo's agrarian economy and some of the challenges because of that in keeping people in the community, especially English converts who had been trained to work in the factories in some of the larger cities in Britain. Leonard tries, where possible, to be fair to outsiders, even Mormons who chose, for whatever reason, to leave the community and also to abandon their faith. The Nauvoo Charter is understood in the context of similar charters, and its features aren't exaggerated as they've been in other histories. And I came away no longer wondering what the University of Nauvoo really was and what it wasn't. I had always been curious about that. Also, did Nauvoo really become the largest city in Illinois, as we've often been taught? And Leonard cites census records that shows that Nauvoo lagged behind Chicago by about 1,000 in its population and not the other way around, as we so often hear. He discusses the concept of the gathering by citing earlier attempts at both a Zion in Missouri and a less idealistic Kirtland in Nauvoo, and how these affected those who had participated in the earlier endeavors. Nauvoo became a mix of those who had been through it all during those periods, as well as those who joined after these earlier explosions. And so Nauvoo was unique in that sense. It became unique also for being a community of being communities within a community, and I think that's most noticeable in the English converts who immigrated and chose to live near each other, to remind each other of the land they'd left and to have that support. And so he does a great job of laying the foundation of placing Nauvoo in its context in America and 19th century America and just what the rest of the nation was growing and how it was developing. We see where Nauvoo was and what it wasn't doing and what it had hoped to accomplish because of that. Some of the things that I noticed, I'm particularly interested in, of course, how he would deal with plural marriage. I think a lot of us are seeing that as really, despite the earlier attempts with Joseph Smith living polygamy, or at least taking a plural wife in Kirtland, we see Nauvoo as the period where that developed and where others became involved and where the doctrine eventually led to his death. There are a few things that I find kind of puzzling, and partially because this is a book that's published by Deseret Book and BYU Press. So there are, I suppose, limitations that, in fact, Glenn Leonard did tell us at MHA that he had that he had included more on the succession crisis than Deseret Book wanted, but he held to his guns and published that. But there are other areas where he is facing that dilemma of writing for a faithful Latter-day Saint audience. And also being true to the actual history of Nauvoo. And I'm a little bit puzzled over some areas in the to do with polygamy. For example, the issue of polyandry. He touches upon that, mentions that the famous story of Heber C. Kimball, Joseph Smith approaching Heber C. Kimball and telling Heber that he wanted his wife. And when Heber finally gave in, he said, "Just kidding," basically. But he also mentions that there are other areas where, or other times, where this doctrine of polyandry was taught, but it was usually non-Mormons or husbands who had approved. I don't think that was the case with Orson Pratt, who was away, or Orson Hyde, who was away at the time, who had some trouble over that, as well as Orson Pratt later on. He mentions that polygamy was illegal in Illinois, which I think will surprise a lot of Mormons who have always been taught, you know, our article of faith of honoring, obeying, and sustaining the law. We felt we always did that. When polygamy became illegal, then we stopped. But at its Nauvoo roots, it was illegal then. So he's able to mention that, but he doesn't, he really doesn't go into polyandry as much as he should. And people might wonder, well, is this something that you should go into? Can a general discussion of polygamy be sufficient? I don't think so. In a book that, Nauvoo was really an experiment. This marriage system was an experiment. Polyandry, Joseph Smith took, I think, a third of his wives had other living husbands at the time. And there's really not enough information on this to really give a true account of the hurt and pain that this caused those involved. And the fact that a third of his wives were polyandrous, I think that deserves some more attention. So I see throughout this that he's really walking a fine line. He's wanting to preach to the, or talk to faithful Latter-day Saints, but also understand that a scholarly community has been anticipating this book for a long time. And so I think he succeeds in some areas, he doesn't in others. But with that just general introduction, I will turn the time over to our panelists.
I think you'll find that there has been no attempt at any kind of correlation among members on the panel, and to those panelists on whose toes I may step, I apologize in advance. Glenn Leonard's long-awaited new history of Nauvoo, Boomtown headquarters from 1839 to 1846 of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, is friendly history at its finest. It is at once insightful, compassionate, and occasionally revisionistic. It gently questions some long and deeply held beliefs about the saints' tumultuous sojourn at the fringes of Western Illinois. The writing is readable and engaging, the meaning clear. The organization is generally chronological, with periodic topical digressions as needed. The tone is respectful, the analysis surprisingly charitable, especially of some of the city's more notorious residents. The call-out epigraphs at the beginnings of all sections and chapters are helpful and provocative. The illustrations, and especially the photographs, alone are just about worth the price of the book, although I wish the captions and the maps, in particular, had been larger. I'm sure some of the detail was lost in the publisher's attempt to rein in what must have seemed an already mammoth project. Glenn's Nauvoo should be required reading for all inquisitive students of Latter-day Saint history. I was especially fascinated by Glenn's discussion of Nauvoo's growth as a city, its physical and particularly administrative infrastructure, including its charter, remarkable in some ways, ordinary in others, civic government, judicial system, and municipal militia, the Nauvoo Legion. Although I have not completely digested Bob Flanders' groundbreaking work on Nauvoo and assume that he discusses many of these same events as well, still, Glenn helped me to make sense of developments I'd previously found confusing. I also benefited from Glenn's careful analysis of Nauvoo's social characteristics, economic makeup, and demographic profile. I was very impressed by his seemingly thorough discussion of the city's problematic involvement in municipal, county, and statewide politics and elections. Quote, "The Latter-day Saint effort to protect their rights through block voting for their political friends," he notes in one of the book's many fair-minded observations, "so alienated the opposition that the division created the very problem the saints had hoped to prevent. The citizens of Western Illinois reacted against what they saw as untenable political and religious threats. In a religion that merged earthly and heavenly kingdoms, all attempts to publicly separate them failed, and the saints themselves shared in both the causes and the consequences of that failure." End quote. Furthermore, Glenn's treatment of the induction of a relatively large portion of the city's adult male population in Masonry answers many questions about this unlikely alliance. His admission of Masonry's mythic, ancient origins is particularly welcome. His description of the temple endowment and mention of the fullness of the priesthood ordinance, sometimes called the second anointing, is illuminating. It is refreshing to read an account of temple ordinances that does not rely on James Talmage's 1911 description. His analysis of the Council of 50 and its narrow role in the church is noteworthy, and certainly makes a convincing case for the release of this not-so-secret body's minutes. His discussion of Joseph Smith and plural or celestial marriage is at once both sensitive and frank, and may be the most intelligent defense of the prophet's controversial teachings to have appeared from the church's semi-official publisher and press of the church's flagship institution of higher education since the late 1800s. In this context, it was interesting to learn that boys could marry in Nauvoo at age 17, girls at age 14, with parental consent, thresholds, Glenn notes, typical for the times. I was captivated by his narrative of Joseph's decision in mid-June 1844 to return to Nauvoo rather than to escape to the West, a recital that does not blame Emma, and eventual removal to Carthage Jail. His downplaying of many of the myths surrounding Joseph's martyrdom, his treatment of the standoff between Brigham Young and Sidney Rigdon for control of the church, and his conclusion that Hiram had been Joseph's designated successor, his portrayal of Nauvoo after Joseph, his recounting of the church's preparations prior to the departure into the wilderness, and the fact that the church's leaders did not know precisely where they were going until less than 2 months before leaving, and his description of the Exodus and Nauvoo as the desolate city. Quote, "The saints who had tried to create a religious community in Nauvoo moved on," he writes in another generous passage. "They remembered Nauvoo and what they had learned during those pleasant, if troubled, days. Many of them recalled Joseph Smith's earliest teachings and treasured what they termed original Mormonism. Others rejected the changes implemented in Nauvoo as a further unfolding of revealed religion. Others embraced the changes. Some had come late to the church, others had found it early, but more important than the length of their membership was what individual saints heard and applied of the prophet's teachings. Thus, while the Nauvoo years did indeed forever change the nature of Mormonism, believers responded differently to the changes. Mormonism meant one thing to the saints who gathered in the Intermountain West, and something else again to those who chose to remain behind in the Midwest. Church members in both places acknowledged the significance of the prophet Joseph's contributions in Nauvoo, but they viewed many of his accomplishments and messages with contrasting levels of acceptance. While my own knowledge of Nauvoo's history is very limited, I did note what seemed to me to be several relatively minor errors. On page 145, second line, Jane Law was married to William, not Wilson Law. On page 320, line 16, ex-Missouri governor Lilburn Boggs was wounded in 1842, not 1843. On page 346, lines 6 to 7, Theodore Turley was not the second polygamist in Nauvoo. Evidence now demonstrates that Turley actually married his first plural wife in March 1844. For years, Turley family history had antedated the marriage of one of Theodore's plural wives in order to give her firstborn son, fathered by another man, legitimate parentage. On page 348, line 13, Eliza and Emily Partridge are called orphans, a common mistake. In fact, only their father had passed away when they moved into Joseph and Emma Smith's house. Their mother Lydia did not die until 1878 in Utah. Again on page 348, line 36, the best evidence now suggests that both John E. Page and Lyman White did enter plural marriage prior to Joseph Smith's death. Joseph Fielding Smith recorded an encounter with Page's widow, who indicated that her husband married a second wife during Joseph's lifetime. And White's most recent biographer writes that by the early fall of 1844, White had three additional wives, one of whom would give birth before the end of the winter, implying that they married before the end of the previous June. On page 361, line 13, Francis Higbee brought suit against Joseph Smith in May 1844, claiming that Joseph had slandered him, not that Joseph had attempted to seduce Nancy Rigdon, although Joseph's proposed marriage to Nancy in 1842 and its fallout was for Francis a wound that never healed. Finally, on page 363, line 1, it was Hiram Smith, not William, who read Joseph's revelation on celestial marriage to the Nauvoo High Council in August 1843. Again, these are minor errors and can easily be corrected if author and publisher agree in a subsequent printing. The best history is always heuristic, and Glenn's is especially stimulating. I wonder about his assertion that John C. Bennett was introduced to church circles through Sidney Rigdon. As Glenn knows, it was actually William McClellan who introduced both Joseph and Sidney to Bennett at the same time. Bennett later contacted Joseph and Sidney together, and Bennett lived with Joseph for some 39 weeks. I suspect that Sidney was no more responsible for Bennett's infiltration of the church hierarchy than was Joseph. Glenn concludes that Joseph did not translate the Kinderhook plates. Yet William Clayton does not seem to leave much room for doubt when he recorded on 1 May 1843, quote, President Joseph Smith has translated a portion and says they contain the history of the person with whom they were found, and he was a descendant of Ham through the loins of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and that he received his kingdom from the ruler of heaven and earth, end quote. On the other hand, Glenn refers to Joseph's Book of Abraham project not as a translation, but as a revelation, explaining, quote, Joseph Smith's biblical studies relied more upon supernatural knowledge than earthbound book learning, end quote. Joseph's introduction of eternal proxy marriage sealings probably occurred earlier than Glenn indicates. He writes that this ordinance was first performed in May 1843 when Joseph married Hiram and Jerusha Smith, Brigham and Miriam Young, and Mercy and Robert Thompson. In fact, the earliest recorded eternal proxy marriage was between Joseph and Caroline Kingsbury, whom Joseph had sealed 2 months earlier on 23 March 1843. The ceiling had been Joseph Smith's way of rewarding Joseph Kingsbury's decision to stand as the civil husband of the prophet's first teenage plural wife, Sarah Ann Whitney, who also happened to be Joseph C.'s sister-in-law. Sarah Ann's public husband would help to divert unwanted public attention in the event of a pregnancy. In fact, there is circumstantial evidence that the first eternal proxy marriage sealings may have actually occurred as early as January or July 1842. Glenn feels that Orrin Porter Rockwell probably didn't attempt to assassinate ex-Governor Lilburn Boggs. I find it interesting that Rockwell never denied the shooting, and Rockwell's biographer, Harold Schindler, clearly implies that the frontiersman was probably guilty. I wish someone someday would attempt to resolve this issue definitively. Glenn rejects Todd Compton's conclusions regarding the total number of plural wives Joseph married during his lifetime. He favors not 33 wives, but 28. He relies on the research of Daniel Bachman and more recently of Scott Fowler and Richard Anderson. Curiously, Glenn does not cite Todd in this context, though he does list his book in his bibliography. Glenn does cite Scott and Richard, whose work appeared as a review of Todd's book. Todd has responded to Scott and Richard, and I believe that Todd's arguments are the more persuasive. If anything, Todd may actually understate the total number of women sealed to Joseph Smith while alive. Glenn believes that, quote, all who eventually accepted the part of the revelation concerning plurality of wives did so only after intense personal struggles, end quote. This might more accurately read that many struggled with the doctrine, not everyone. Especially the men, had first to be confronted with an angel brandishing an unsheathed sword before embracing Joseph's new teaching. Glenn is commendably balanced in his treatment of John C. Bennett, the traitor Mormons love to hate. However, he asserts without question that Bennett was excommunicated from the church. Bennett always insisted that he first withdrew with Joseph's blessing, but that later the historical record was altered to read that he had been formally expelled. The official record book of the proceedings of the Nauvoo Stake High Council offers some indication that Bennett may be correct on this point. In an unrelated instance, a member asked that his name be removed from church records, but was nonetheless tried and disfellowshipped. In fact, his request to withdraw was crossed out in the official record of his trial. My own guess is that Bennett was allowed to withdraw, but the record was subsequently changed to read that the church had formally acted to expel him. Glenn also seems to imply that Bennett was alone in using Joseph Smith's name to introduce women to his counterfeit of the prophet's teachings. In fact, Joseph's own brother William told at least two women that the prophet privately sanctioned such relationships. Glenn also, in my opinion, simplifies the situation regarding Bennett and Orson and Sarah Pratt. He accepts the claim that Bennett attempted to seduce Sarah, yet Sarah blamed her and Orson's temporary withdrawal from church participation on Joseph Smith's romantic overtures, not Bennett's. Sarah's biographer, Richard Van Wagner, whom Glenn does not reference, concluded 16 years ago that Sarah's name was not associated with Bennett until after Joseph had confronted the prophet. I think the evidence better accommodates the conclusion that Joseph did in fact invite Sarah to become his plural wife during Orson's absence to England, but perhaps, and this is a big perhaps, only to test her virtue. Again regarding Bennett, but this time in connection with William Law, Glenn says that Law had, quote, believed Bennett's exaggerated claims of immoral behavior, end quote. While Law adamantly opposed plural marriage, he in fact denounced Bennett in 1842 as, quote, our open enemy who is engaged in circulating falsehoods of the blackest character, end quote. Law did not believe Bennett's claims in 1842, and only after being initiated a member of Joseph's anointed quorum, seen of the first temple ceremonies, and later reading for himself Joseph's revelation on celestial or plural marriage, did he come to accept the fact that the prophet was advocating the marital innovation. In appearing before the Nauvoo City Council to urge the suppression of the Nauvoo Expositor, Hiram Smith said that his brother's revelation, quote, was in answer to a question concerning things which transpired in former days, end quote. Glenn cites the version of these minutes published in the History of the Church. The fuller version published in the Nauvoo Neighbor adds 8 more words to Hiram's assertion, quote, and had no reference to the present time, end quote. The paper, the Nauvoo Neighbor, also reprints Hiram's second denial, to which Glenn does not refer, that the revelation, quote, was in reference to former days and not the present times, end quote. Again, the history of the church does not print the last five words of Hiram's comments. The history of the church does not publish Hiram's full denials because those church historians who compiled and wrote the bulk of Joseph's history knew they weren't true. While I don't believe Glenn was obligated to point out Hiram's lie, it would have been interesting if he had at least alerted readers to the patriarch's misstatements. Glenn's treatment of the succession of Brigham Young as de facto president of the church is thorough and reasonable. As I already mentioned, he believes that Joseph appointed Hiram as his successor. Glenn also believes that the original Quorum of the Twelve was Joseph's next choice, that the possibility of alternative options may have been viable at specific moments in church history, but that by 1844, Joseph had arrived at certain conclusions about his successor. Glenn may be correct. Still, it is not as apparent to me that Joseph had managed sufficiently to foresee the need for a successor. I wonder if Joseph actually believed that he would die a young man. I think the evidence is compelling that he fully expected he would live to lead his church into Texas or the Pacific Northwest. The 12 may have been, in retrospect, the most logical or prepared choice to succeed Joseph, but I'm not entirely convinced that's what Joseph actually had in mind. Glenn treads cautiously on the topic of Brigham's transfiguration into Joseph on 8 August 1844. In fact, I doubt he uses the term transfiguration. He does, however, quote from reminiscent accounts that would lead most readers to conclude that many saints believed Brigham's succession had been divinely sanctioned. While I wish Glenn had pointed out some of the problems of such reminiscent accounts, I admit that he seems to have fairly represented the beliefs of some in attendance that morning. At the same time, Glenn dismisses stories of divine intervention having prevented the mobbers from decapitating Joseph following his death, and correctly points out that none of the prophet's murderers died an unnatural, grisly, or premature death. Nor regarding Brigham's formal assumption of the presidency and reorganization of the first presidency in late 1847, does Glenn mention earthquakes and other divine expressions of approval that some saints later noted. Glenn's discussion of post-martyrdom church-sanctioned vigilantism clearly seeks to distance church leaders from such extra-legal activities, and in the main I believe he is correct. However, there are instances where church leaders seemingly favored the use of intimidation, if not violence. Consider, for example, the following two entries from William Clayton's diary. July 10, 1844. Evening, a committee of nine women, among whom were Hiram Smith's widow, Arthur Milliken's wife, and Sister Phelps, visited Robert D. Foster and told him they should not hear his taunts and insults any longer, and they demanded that he should leave the city forthwith or he would be visited by a stronger force tomorrow. Hiram Kimball obligated himself that Foster should leave before morning. Accordingly, he got his team ready and took him out of the city. The doctor was much frightened and looked every way for fear someone would be upon him. He has gone away and there are hopes that he will never return. July 11, 1844, a.m., the sisters say they will wait upon Sylvester Emmons and S.M. Marr and order them to leave. The saints no doubt felt justified in ridding themselves of their enemies. I suspect such actions were not as rare as some may feel. Finally, a concluding thought on Glenn's use of sources, and this is Devery touched on this. While his notes and bibliography seem thorough and comprehensive, they in fact omit reference to some works that, to my mind at least, are conspicuous by their absence. I realize that Glenn simply may not have had sufficient time to review all relevant works, or felt their contents were not germane, or perhaps he or his publisher did not want to draw readers' attention to some works for whatever reason. I have already noted his partial omission of Todd Compton's near definitive In Sacred Loneliness, The Plural Wives of Joseph Smith. Other omissions include M. Guy Bishop's articles on baptism for the dead and on eternal marriage, Martha Bradley on Zina Diantha Huntington Jacob Smith, David John Berger on the endowment ceremony and second anointing, Andrew E. Hatt's master's thesis, Joseph Smith's Introduction of Temple Ordinances and the 1844 Mormon Succession Question, Scott Falwing's edition of An American Prophet's Record, The Diaries and Journals of Joseph Smith, though Glenn does cite Dean Jesse's edition of Joseph's Diaries, Michael Homer on Mormonism and Masonry, Myrtle Hyde's biography of Orson Hyde, Michael Quinn's The Mormon Hierarchy, Origins of Power, and neither Richard Van Wagner's Mormon Polygamy a History nor his Sidney Rigdon, A Portrait of Religious Excess. Reference to the latter would have greatly bolstered Glenn's discussion of Rigdon's mood swings. If intentional, such omissions prevent an author from acknowledging debts to previous scholarship and readers from turning to additional resources and more detailed discussions. Glenn's sympathy for the saints may be his greatest strength in this undertaking, as well as for more critically minded readers, his greatest weakness. I suspect some readers may be put off by Glenn's pro-Mormon stance. Indeed, after reading Nauvoo, A Place of Peace, A People of Promise, it is difficult to think of a more persecuted, more misunderstood, but ultimately more honest and well-meaning people in all of American history than the city's Mormon population. Of course, this isn't true, and I believe Glenn would be the first to admit that most non-traditional, even fringe religions or other movements, would no doubt describe themselves using similar terms. I realize that Glenn's interpretations occasionally differ from mine, even when we're both reading the same sources. What I most appreciate is his ability to make the dreams, hopes, and admirations of Nauvoo's saints comprehensible, even desirable. Glenn has helped me to feel what it must have been like to have walked the same muddy streets as Joseph, Hiram, and Brigham, John, William, and Wilson, Emma, Eliza, and Lucy, and I am grateful for that experience. Thanks.
I appreciate being able to critique Nauvoo, A Place of Peace, A People Promised by Glenn Leonard. Though the book discusses some of the political, economic, and social issues of the day, it is the key religious issues and themes that the book proposed to offer. The preface sets the tone for the volume by stating that the real story of the church in Nauvoo is essentially one of a people of faith. It is the unfolding of temple doctrines to a gathered people during the 7-year Nauvoo period of church history that attracts the attention in this study. And because the enduring legacy of Mormon Nauvoo for those who care the most about its history is religious, it makes sense to tell the story from the perspective of revelations and doctrines. The organization of the book is divided into 21 chapters with maps and illustrations. The illustrations and maps are helpful with additional background in the credits at the end of the book. This work does not shy away from the succession controversy in chapter 15, which is titled, Who Shall Lead the Church? And includes illustrations of Joseph Smith III and James J. Strang. One item of interest is the City Council of Nauvoo issued a $1 note to be redeemed by the city treasurer on demand if any monies in the treasury not otherwise appropriated. But the script was recalled only after a short time. Ellen Pratt's report card, recorded by her mother and preserved in the Addison Pratt Bible, says that Ellen has 35 credits marks for her studies. The book is also willing to give a brief discussion of plural marriage. I will come back later to this. A central focus in the book is certainly the building of the Nauvoo Temple. The January 1841 revelation created a great burden upon the saints during the Nauvoo era. Many of the saints were not financially able to assist by monetary means to donate to the temple. And Glenn Leonard's book describes the way this was handled by having a tithing of 1 day in 10 to work on some manner on the temple. The temple endowment became an established part of Latter-day Saint ceremonial worship inside the temple in January 1845, January and February 1846, with over 5,000 members going through the ordinances. Joseph Smith had performed the endowment in the upper room of his store, and in the temple the ceremony was modified for the attic story. Many church members who were invited to participate in the temple ordinances of anointing, sealing, and endowment were responsive to their obligations of support for the church. Some religious topics not discussed are, one, in Joseph Smith's day, it was permitted that proxy baptisms could be performed by either sex for deceased individuals. Brigham Young simplified this by instructing males to be baptized for males and females for females. Two, rebaptism was for the remission of sins and further commitment to the church. Wilfred Woodruff recorded in his journal for March 27, 1842, after meeting, closed the congregation, again assembled upon the banks of the river, and Joseph the seer went into the river and baptized all that came unto him. And I considered it my privilege to be baptized for the remission of my sins, for I had not since I first joined the church in 1833. Third, the question arising regarding who has the most priesthood authority, 70s or high priest. Brigham Young settled the issue in a discourse in the Nauvoo Temple. This was omitted when Volume 7 of the History of the Church was published in 1932. Fourth, modification of the temple doctrines incorporated in the Holy Endowment. Joseph Smith arranged the ceremony to be performed in the upper story of his store in May 1842 for 2 days, and then recommenced the endowment in May 1843. Brigham Young made use of the upper attic floor of the Nauvoo Temple, modifying by trial and error the endowment ceremony. He enlarged the religious ceremony for the larger area. In reading the text, I came across a few items that need correction. Concerning a pre-Nauvoo event, a caption of an illustration of a mob in Independence, Missouri in July 1833 mentions the store of Oliver Granger and N.K. Whitney. The name should be Sidney Gilbert rather than Granger. The book mentions John C. Bennett, who became an assistant counselor in the First Presidency, and that he was introduced to Joseph Smith and Sidney Rigdon by William McClellan in Kirkland, Ohio in 1832. The endnote refers to the saintly scoundrel, The Life and Times of Dr. John Cook Bennett, which a careful reading indicates that rather than Kirkland, the location of the first meeting was in Hiram, Ohio. And as Gary mentioned, the text says Wilson and his wife Jane were especially generous with their substantial resources. It was not Wilson, but William. On the Nauvoo Expositor case, it is written about the revelation on plural marriage. William and Jane Law and Austin Coles testify that they heard William Smith read the revelation. As Gary also pointed out, this is not correct. Two of the three affidavits state it was Hiram Smith and not William who read the document. In writing about former apostle William E. McClellan, who did not go west with Brigham Young, the book states that after the 1840s, he never again affiliated with any religious group. Again, here is a case of not carefully checking. The endnote refers to Larry Porter's article, Odyssey of William Earl McClellan, in the journals of William E. McClellan, 1831 to 1836, but not to page 351 of that book, where it states that McClellan followed leader Granville Hedrick of what is today known as the Church of Christ Temple Lot, and was baptized into that faith on June 5th, 1869. His affiliation lasted only 4 months. In the text, it was brought out that at the October 1840 church conference, John C. Bennett gave some very appropriate remarks that were later dropped from the historical record. The endnote is not clear when it states that his comments were omitted when the minutes from the Times and Seasons were published in the Millennial Star, nor are they in the History of the Church. Since the conference minutes were not published in England, maybe this note refers to the compilation of the manuscript history. In another place, it is told that merchants in Nauvoo were chastised for failing to contribute to the poor. The end note refers to the words of Joseph Smith, whose text comes from Wilford Woodruff's journal, and states, "This emphasis on the poor was not included in the report in History of the Church." But the poor is mentioned in all three references. Concerning the Kinderhook plates that were assumed to be an ancient record, an endnote states, "The Prophet's Journal kept by Willard Richards, May 1st to 9th, 1843, does not mention the plates." The journal does mention Joseph being visited by several gentlemen concerning the plates. Another note discusses the 1840 Book of Mormon by stating, "Royal Skousen corrects Chad Flake's earlier assumption that Ebenezer Robinson and Don Carlos Smith printed the 1840 edition at Nauvoo. Robinson contracted for both stereotyping and printing in Ohio." In this case, there is no contradiction, since the title page of the 1840 edition of the Book of Mormon has this information, and Chad Flake does list the printing as being in Ohio. Since plural marriage is mentioned in some of the book's chapters, it is appropriate to briefly discuss this topic. It is good that the book point out the role that an angel played in Joseph Smith having women sealed to him in the bonds of celestial marriage. It reminds me of when Emily Dahl Partridge Smith Young testified in the Temple Lot case. "Joseph Smith told me, he himself, that the angel had appeared unto him and had given him that revelation." Illinois law, enacted as early as 1833, included among its provisions with punishment bigamy, consisting in having of two wives or two husbands at one and the same time, knowing that the former husband or wife is still alive. On conviction thereof, be punished by a fine not exceeding $1,000 and imprisoned in the penitentiary not exceeding 2 years. If any man or woman being unmarried shall knowingly marry the husband or wife of another, such man or woman shall on conviction be fined not more than $500 or imprisoned not more than 1 year. It is true that we do not have all of Joseph Smith's teachings expounded to the women who were sealed to him. The book states that after the death of Smith, much of the information disclosed in the practice of plural marriage in Nauvoo originated in the East with Sidney Rigdon and his followers. Rigdon's periodical, The Latter-day Saint Messenger and Advocate, published in Pittsburgh, contains a letter that explained, "And now one word with respect to the plurality of life doctrine. It is contrary to the laws of the land and is therefore wrong. For we are told in the Book of Covenants that if we keep the commandments of the Lord, we need not transgress the laws of the land." In an endnote, the book quotes an anonymous LDS writer in response to an article to Rigdon's Messenger and Advocate. It confirmed, "The law of the land and the rule of the church do not allow one man to have more than one wife alive at a time." There is no mention of an 1840 to Revelation in the book that instructs elders to go out on a public relations effort to counter John C. Bennett's letters against the church. A broadside was published containing affidavits and certificates against the Bennett disclosures. Peter Crawley wrote, "Generally, the Mormon counterattack was successful in blunting Bennett's expose, but not without a cost, without a toll, excuse me. The charges and countercharges certainly were demoralizing to the Latter-day Saints in Nauvoo and the outlying branches. When an opposite party to Joseph Smith printed their first issue of the Nauvoo Expositor in June 1844, it included three affidavits that they stated they heard Smith's 1843 revelation of a doctrine of men can have more wives than one. A campaign ensued to destroy its influence. This led to the destruction of the Expositor Press and in part contributed to the events that led to the death of the Smith brothers 2 weeks later. But the disclosures of Nauvoo polygamy were brought to the attention of the general public over 2 years earlier in 1842 and a year after Joseph Smith's first known Nauvoo sealing in 1841. John C. Bennett, who himself was involved with female companions, exposed in part the spiritual wife doctrine as it related to church president Joseph Smith. In Bennett's book, The History of the Saints, he wrote, "Smith was privately married to his spiritual wives, and his list, without actually naming the seven spiritual or plural wives, three of those sealed were Miss Louisa Beeman, sealed by Joseph B. Noble in April 1841. Another one was Mrs. Priscinda Huntington Buell, wife of Norman Buell, sealed in December 1841 by Dimmick Huntington, and Agnes Coolbrith Smith, widow of Don Carlos Smith, sealed by the Apostle Brigham Young in January 1842. The book does point out that after Joseph Smith's first sealings, others, including Brigham Young and Heber C. Kimball, entered into plural marriage. It says that Joseph's wife Emma was at times supportive of her husband's plural marriage relationships, and that she sanctioned Joseph's marriage to the orphan teenagers Emily and Eliza Partridge. It should have been explained a little better. Of the reported four ladies sealed to Smith with Emma's approval, the two Partridge sisters sealed were repeated ceremonies. Contrary to the text, only Emily was a teenager, being 19, when sealed for the second time to Smith in May 1843. It's possible that the book may have mentioned the teenagers, actually one teenager being orphaned, since the father, the former bishop, Edward Partridge, was deceased. But, of course, their mother was still alive. The July 1843 revelation was given a little over a month later, partly in response to Emma. It appears that a better job could have been done in getting some of the texts, and especially the endnotes, correct. On the whole, I found the book to be stimulating and a good resource for further inquiry into Nauvoo history. Thank you.
Typically, when I'm asked to be on a panel like this at Sunstone, it's because they felt like it'd be good to have an RLDS person, you know, for balance. And I think it's just because they want to give truth a chance. But at any rate, But I think when you have a book on Nauvoo, especially in our LDS perspective, we view Nauvoo quite differently than the LDS do. I think that's quite clear. When Devery commented on how on the possibility of an independence temple for the LDS sometime, it reminded me of my fear that just as soon as we got our temple built, you guys would tear down the visitor center across the street and throw up a big temple that would leave us in the shadow. But fortunately, that hasn't happened. And I'll use the term RLDS, even though on April 6th, 2001, a date that might not have been chosen at random, the RLDS Church magically became the Community of Christ. But everything I'm going to talk about is before that date, so I'll use RLDS. My colleague in the next office at Graceland, historian philosopher Paul Madison Edwards, went to the 1968 World Conference, where they approved as a revelation what became Section 149, which called for the saints to get to work and prepare to build the temple in independence that had been historically expected. Well, Paul was appalled at the prophet's revelation. You know, is this temple going to have secret rituals like baptism for the dead, sealings for time and eternity, and so forth? Well, if you're not happy with the revelation, make your views known. So Paul arranged for a meeting with Duane Cooey of the First Presidency. Cooey reassured Paul that there would be no secret rituals, no baptism for the dead, no sealings and so forth. There would be lots of educational functions going on in the temple. Of course, Paul later headed those, as well as worship activities. Paul felt a bit relieved, but I doubt that he was completely at ease about the temple. I think the image Paul was conjuring up in his mind was the Nauvoo Temple. This inspiration to the saints out west, newly rebuilt in all of its majesty, raised in Paul's mind the elements of our history that we, RLDS, would rather forget and leave behind. That is the whole Nauvoo period. Alma Blair was probably the first to articulate the thesis that the RLDS Church has traditionally proclaimed a theology reasonably consistent with the Mormon theology that existed at the end of the Kirtland period in about 1838. What does the RLDS Church do with Nauvoo? I'll put it a little stronger than is normally the case, but this is my answer. We reject Nauvoo completely. Every innovation in doctrine and practice that is associated with the Nauvoo period we rejected. Some we rejected right away, others we had to think about it for a while. Plurality of wives, plurality of gods, baptism for the dead and the other temple rituals, the church-state non-separation that existed in Nauvoo, and we certainly wanted a church that was much more democratic. Glenn's thorough treatment of the issues related to Nauvoo will help the RLDS reader clarify why we are a rejection of Nauvoo. It would help us understand the LDS teachings and traditions and why we split. Glenn has written a very impressive book on Nauvoo. He seems to be aware of about all of the primary sources that are available, as well as the secondary sources. This is a great book for understanding the worldview and the religion of Mormon Nauvoo, as well as the political, economic, and social aspects. Glenn gives a very fair treatment of the RLDS Church. Not many LDS scholars are as well informed about the RLDS as he is. And he really didn't have to include as much about the RLDS Church as he did, and so we certainly, I'm sure, appreciate that. Glenn and Alma Blair and other RLDS historians are on the same page on this matter. You know, Glenn says that the RLDS Church adopted the pre-Nauvoo pattern as its model of the Restoration. He says that the RLDS wished to severely limit ecclesiastical involvement in the political, economic, and social spheres of life, and that's certainly us. Glenn says the Articles of Faith reflected what the LDS believed when they arrived in Nauvoo. Therefore, the RLDS consensus in our theology for over a century or more could almost totally embrace your Articles of Faith, that is, the Kirtland theology. Glenn doesn't mention that Joseph Smith didn't bother to trouble John Wentworth with the more esoteric doctrines and practices that he was already initiating in Nauvoo. Our epitome of faith that we published for a long time was really quite close to your Articles of Faith, and at first glance it would appear there wasn't a great difference between the two churches. Now, having said all these nice things about the book, Glenn, if he listens to this tape, will probably be surprised, if not shocked. Well, I don't want to leave him in a state of permanent shock, so I realize that a history of the church by Deseret Brooke is not likely to regard the critics of the church as fine people who in good conscience oppose the church. The Book of Mormon seems to see opposition in all things as healthy, as did the emerging political culture in America at the time, led by the work of New York's Martin Van Buren in the 1820s, according to Richard Hofstadter. But the saints have tended not to appreciate criticism. We don't see the critic as the loyal opposition, as Senator Van Buren did. Glenn has less of the tendency to see the saints as the good guys and the others as the bad guys than I would expect in an in-house history. So my criticism of this score on this score is a gentle one by a Gentile. One tendency for in-house historians is that the good guys always get the benefit of the doubt while the bad guys don't. For example, Glenn writes of the saints at Nauvoo, "Ultimately, bonds of friendship, kinship, and shared experience did not matter as much as covenants of faith." Well, maybe so, but that's a very difficult judgment to make. It requires getting into the minds of people who have been dead a long time, most of whom had left no surviving records. But on the other hand, when he looks at William Law, Glenn seems to see his religious beliefs as less important than the disagreements he had with Joseph over temporal matters. Yet it seems on the very next page that Law's anti-polygamy views really are the core of his dissent. Another example is when discussing the August 1844 conflict between Brigham and Sidney, which RLDS have talked about endlessly. Glenn writes, "The members who voted their own minds in support of the 12 meant it." How do we know they voted their own minds and that they meant it? And wouldn't it be more likely in situations like this that those in the minority would be more likely to have voted their own minds and been more likely to have really meant it? Glenn says that some were misled by Strang's claims and refers to this as a sifting. Well, I've always objected when I've been referred to as being sifted, and I think the Strangites would probably today, several hundred of them probably would too. In his review of this book in the Deseret News, June 16th of this year, Dennis Lithgow says that Glenn is determined to tell the whole story and so he never glosses over problems. Well, I have to say that he sometimes glosses over problems, and maybe there's no better example than his treatment of the Nauvoo expositor. And that's certainly a problem. Maybe about the worst incident in Nauvoo. Glenn suggests that since the publishers of the expositor were no longer in the church, the only recourse, quote unquote, the church had was to turn to the city government. Well, I'm sorry, but they had no recourse at all. They're out of the church. That would be like the church today just deciding that since Levina and Janice have been excommunicated, the church has no recourse but to have the Salt Lake City police break into their study and confiscate their notes so they can't publish the next issue of the case reports of the Mormon Alliance. Actually, I hope I didn't give anybody any ideas there. Of course, if Glenn had stated the obvious, that it was a gross violation of our constitutional principles, Deseret would have removed those offending sentences as not faith-promoting. Glenn told Dennis Lithgow of the news that Lauren Dunn read this book, read the manuscript, and that the manuscript did not have to go through the general authorities, and he didn't have any battles with Deseret Book or BYU Press over the book. Well, possibly Elder Dunn didn't need to pass it on to the general authorities because it didn't criticize Joseph's indefensible actions on the expositor and other sensitive issues. I do thank Glenn for citing Governor Ford's objections to the Nauvoo City Council's action, so we get the truth of the matter from the outsider, but no acknowledgement that the church was terribly wrong and the governor was actually right. The expositor was published on Friday, June 7th. On Saturday, the City Council adopted an ordinance to make what was done yesterday illegal. The good saints of the council took the Sabbath off, which we're glad to hear. And then on Monday, they have the press destroyed. A bit of an ex post facto problem here. And, of course, a problem with regard to freedom of press and speech and religion. Glenn says it was not the first time a printing press had been destroyed. Okay. He might have mentioned and contrasted the destruction of the Book of Commandments in Missouri in 1833. But that was done by wicked people, and of course this one was done by good people. Lithgow also says that Emma Smith's opposition to the practice of polygamy was well documented in the book here. But Glenn really tells us very little of that story. On the matter of polygamy, I think Glenn needs to give dissenters more credit. And he puts too much blame on John C. Bennett, you know, for other people's views. He was against the law of Illinois, and much more importantly, he was considered immoral and repugnant to civilized society in the Christian world, and especially in the United States. Of course, there would be people who would resist such a radical departure from Christian moral teachings. And of course, Emma would resist. She was an intelligent, morally upstanding woman and the wife of the prophet. So when Glenn says that in 1832 the prophet believed that the time has not yet come for it to be practiced, the skeptic has to say, well, yeah, he hasn't yet figured out a way to get this by Emma and the rest of the church. If there's anyone here who hasn't been skeptical when you heard Joseph's claim of the three visits by the angel with a threat of death if he doesn't introduce polygamy wives, be sure and raise that during the discussion period. Of course the RLDS people objected on moral grounds and good conscience to polygamy, and I assume that is generally true of others that didn't end up in the RLDS church. If Gordon B. Hinckley resumed the doctrine today, I suspect there would be some dissenters. It seems strange that for Joseph in his inner circle, practicing polygamy is a virtue, but for the others it is lust or something akin to that. It's only okay if you have permission from the prophet. I'm sorry, but that reminds me of an interview I had with Damon Lundgren, 21-year-old son of the Kirtland murderer, Jeff Lundgren, who was explaining to me at the Mansfield prison his father's theology of plural wives, because he took on plural wives, as you might know. And I'm sorry for it's a rather crude, brief statement of the Lundgren theology of plural wives, but the way Damon put it to me was, you can put your penis where you want to if God says it's okay. Well, the approval by the prophet seems a bit strange to me. As an RLDS person, let me acknowledge that the best case can be made for the 12 and Brigham to lead the church after June of 1844. Despite what RLDS traditionally said, I've always felt that 12 were the logical ones. Even if the prophet wanted his son to succeed him, of course he was only 11 and a half. Unfortunately, that first succession became a precedent followed by both of our churches, in seniority in your case and lineage in our case. We used to argue which system is best. 30 years ago, I published an editorial saying that the question of which system is the worst is really the question, lineage or seniority. Glenn treats the succession issue very well, especially regarding the RLDS. While he relies on secondary sources, when he does rely on secondary sources, though, he tends to look to Ron Esplin's article, which is good, but he doesn't seem to use either Michael Quinn's two excellent articles on the subject in BYU Studies and in John Whitmer. The sources Glenn uses are really impressive, and I really am nitpicking on this. And Eva, it's already been pointed out that Todd Compton's in Sacred Loneliness, there are times when I expected it in the notes, and he's just listed in the bibliography. Glenn says that the prophet's new translation of the Bible would await publication another time, but doesn't tell us that it was published in 1867 by the RLDS Church. Instead, he footnotes Bob Matthews' book on the subject written more than a century later. On the evolution of the scriptural text, he would have been helped by Richard Howard's 1969 MHA award-winning book on the subject. And I suppose that any book published by Deseret isn't going to mention or even list in the bibliography von McKay Brody. So far, the definitive work on Nauvoo has been written by Bob Flanders, who was the division chairperson who hired me at Graceland, and then no sooner than had hired me, he quit. I wasn't really sure how to take that. But anyway, his book was widely criticized in the RLDS Church for one primary reason. Flanders concluded that Joseph Smith was a polygamist, and therefore the RLDS Church's historic denials were incorrect. Flanders was active as an elder in the Lamoni congregation, a former church appointee, full-time minister, and so forth. He would have liked to have been able to conclude that Joseph Smith was not a polygamist, as his co-religionists had proclaimed for more than a century. But Flanders followed where the evidence led and wrote what seemed clearly to be true regarding polygamy. He really didn't want to have the First Presidency and other high officials holding strategy meetings to decide how to handle his book, and he certainly was unprepared for the experience of having people who never read the book condemn him. But Flanders did what a historian should do and didn't try to bend history to his denominational orthodoxy. Does Glenn Leonard's book here replace Flanders? I will give you a definitive answer that you've been waiting for. Well, yes and no. I think Glenn's book will not replace Flanders for secular historians, and probably not for professional historians within the Latter-day Saint churches. For them, perhaps, it would be best to say that the two books complement each other. Flanders decided not to give a lot of attention to the religion of Mormon Nauvoo, perhaps because he was writing it as a dissertation at the University of Wisconsin, and he was a reorganized Mormon, so to speak. Leonard rightly states that you can't understand Nauvoo without understanding the religion of Mormon Nauvoo. And so I say that you need Glenn Leonard for a fuller understanding of Mormon religion, and Flanders remain the best source for the secular aspects of Mormon Nauvoo. I also think that Flanders is more objective than Glenn. Flanders seems more willing to let the facts take him where they lead. If the conclusions are unhappy ones, for example, that Joseph was a polygamist, despite the denials and so forth, then so be it. It seems to me that Glenn usually manages to allow Joseph Smith to land on his feet, never on his head or his back or not even a belly flop now and then. I think Glenn's Nauvoo will be the book rank and file Mormons will find most suitable for a long time. I think the faults are to be expected, and Glenn commits fewer of the kinds of flaws that I expected to see in in-house history of Mormonism. I wish the church was willing to encourage more honesty in writing about its past, but that day seems far off. And if it's too much to read the 660 pages or so, then maybe you can just wait for the film that I'm sure Richard Dutcher will want to produce. So.
Okay, we have about 25 minutes, I guess, for questions. We get out at what time? Quarter to one. Okay, I can remember when we started. So we've got some time, so we can take your questions. Levina. I'll just repeat the question that the question was, does Flanders' book still hold up in light of all the research that's been done on Nauvoo since the book was published in 65?
Yeah. Well, one thing I did not do is review Flanders' book for this session like I would like to have reviewed it, but I'm really no authority on this, but at least it seemed to me that Flanders has not been criticized significantly in the 35 years. I can't think of a historian, again, might be wrong, and others in the panel might be able to correct me or somebody in the audience, but I think his, despite all the 37 years of further work, I don't think his book has been criticized in a significant way. So I just kind of toss this question on to others.
I think that's the answer to that one. I think the rest of us probably own Flanders, but maybe haven't read it yet. So. But we've accomplished the first step. So, any more questions? Yes.
Why and how their garden bodies, brothers, and sons, remarried, raised children.
I'll let you repeat the question.
The question is, why can I say that, why do RLDS reject Nauvoo when Emma, who I would say in a way is kind of our founder in terms of her support for her sons getting involved and so forth, how can I or the church, you know, reject Nauvoo because of what Emma is? Well, I can't think of any of these what I call the Nauvoo innovations, polygamy, plurality of gods and so forth, baptism of the dead, I can't think of any which Emma ever endorsed. So, you know, she lived there and had her children there and friends and so forth, and continued there after the death of her husband and remarried. In fact, we often have kind of used that in the other way, the fact that she married this Methodist guy on her deceased husband's birthday, was often been seen as suggesting she didn't have much use. So I think it's because of the doctrinal and the social practices like plurality of gods that RLDS finally just have to reject it. But sure, Emma liked the place, I guess, because she stayed there. But I don't see that as inconsistent, I guess. Maybe others would, you know.
More questions?
Yes. This is a follow-up question for Bill. How then, what is Nauvoo for most RLDS people? Is it something they would just as soon forget? Is it a big mistake? Was it a nightmare? What? How do you deal with that in your own history?
Yeah. Well, yeah, I certainly wouldn't want to give the impression that all RLDS people think like I do about Nauvoo. But initially, since we were pretty fundamental in our view of scriptures and so forth until fairly recently, and yet intellectually or emotionally or whatever, we were rejecting these various doctrines, then what we did is simply rewrite history. I mean, and of course, it's a difficulty that the son of the prophet became our first president, and I think for him, you know, his father being faithful to his mother is probably an extremely important question as to the legitimacy of Mormonism and the movement. And so, and over time, I mean, he's kind of tentative at first, but over time he becomes harder and harder in his perspective that Joseph Smith, that his father was not a polygamist. So we rewrote the history of polygamy. It's not till 1983 that church historian Dick Howard publishes an article in the John Wimber Journal that I guess it probably was going on with Joseph involved. And then on plurality of gods. Maybe the thing to say then, we simply rewrote the history to reflect our theological conclusions. But RLDS, most of them, even today, I think, probably still don't understand that Nauvoo is such a problem. And so still many of the reorganized saints still accept the myths that were published in all the criticisms we wrote of Utah, you know, books like Fundamental Differences Between the Two Churches by Edward A. Smith, a descendant, and by Apostles Russell Ross and Apostle Leah Curry and so forth. Many people would still hold that revisionist false history, but those who have looked at the historical record more carefully then simply have to say, and I think if you're somewhat fundamental still, you'll say, well, Joseph Smith became a fallen prophet in Nauvoo, and so we kind of reject everything. Now, I think that's not an adequate question. I think Joseph Smith was both a true and a false prophet from day one till his death. I don't think, you know, I don't think in those terms of black and white terms, but many would. And then others in the church, you know, take a position similar to what I take, and that is, you know, he just got so far off the beam that we just can't accept, for a variety of reasons, the conclusions of Nauvoo. And most of those things raise much more serious conflict with the society around us. And we're the ones in the Midwest dealing with with Protestant society, and you guys are hiding out here in the West and don't have to worry about that. So I think for a variety of reasons, you know, the way I would put it is Joseph just had too much power, and it went to his head, and a lot of people who are not dictators, but have too much power, and everybody accepts them, whatever they say is from God or whatever. It's easy to get carried away. If you died in the Liberty Jail, you know, we would have had basically an RLDS type of theology, I suppose, carried on after his death. If he'd lived for another 10 or 15 years, who knows which direction Mormonism might have gone.
Yes.
I'm interested in the statement in the war, the text of Paul, the title of the book, War, Place, and Peace. I haven't heard anything, but I'm going to suggest that that's an appropriate title, part of the title. Why does that include that in all?
Okay. The question is why, how was Nauvoo a place of peace? Based on the title. Yeah.
Our title's chosen to sell books.
You know, it's you can't speak for somebody who's not here, but I think that what Glenn was doing was saying that for the majority of saints in Nauvoo, they saw it as a place of peace, or they wanted to see it as a place of peace. And, you know, we view it as, you know, something happening every day that would lead you to think that it wasn't a place of peace. But I think he would say that for most people, it was, or that's really what they wanted it to be. That would be my guess. That certainly, but also probably for most people it was. You know, most people probably just went about their lives and didn't really know what was going on, or at least, you know, a lot of the secret things that were going on, and they just, you know, it was a pretty good place. I imagine most people saw it as a pretty good place to be during most of that time.
Yes.
So, since the RLDS Church has accepted the fact that we change our mind about polygamy, will we change our mind about? So we'll go back to baptism for the dead and play the plurality of gods and so forth. Well, I think it's very unlikely, since we pretty much moved into mainstream Protestantism as in the process of moving from a sect to a denomination. So pretty unlikely, but you're in a very influential position as the former president of the temple and your retired president of the temple school to kind of carry the ball on baptism for the dead or plurality of gods. If we accept the doctrine of plurality of gods, you're well positioned to become one, so I think I'd go ahead and move. Yes, in the back.
I'm curious, what are the forces that led to rejection of the doctrine? Were they just too weird for the people at the time? Or was it the attempt to accommodate to the cultural milieu that you were in? That sort of problem. As we watch our attempts to accommodate to America, the way we talk outside, the way we talk inside, I'm curious what forces were at play and what we were
The question is, what led the RLDS Church to reject these Nauvoo doctrines?
Well, I think both the things you suggested are probably very much important part of it. On the one hand, you put it as they were too weird, but I mean, on the other hand, I mean, on the one, what I would say is, you know, polygamy especially is just so contrary to Western Christian moral teachings and so forth. Plurality of gods, you know, ancient Israel, it wasn't until about the 5th century that finally, or 6th century, 6th century, that finally you have ancient Israel not only proclaiming that Yahweh is their God, but is the only God that exists. So it seemed like it turns 180 degrees on what was a slow evolving perception in ancient Israel. And Baptism for the Dead is the one that lingers the longest. As late as 1960, future apostle Elia Curry, Ralston, in his book, he suggests that we might have baptism for the dead if we ever get a temple built. And I think that's one reason why Paul Edwards, 8 years later, went down to the Duane Cooley and said, what's going on here? Because I think, even though that's still part of our tradition, by this time, we're so acculturated in a Midwest, you know, halfway house between Protestantism and Salt Lake City, that we weren't about to take a move back toward that. But yeah, I do think that the Nauvoo doctrines are further afield from mainstream Protestantism. So the Book of Mormon and other, you know, the Joseph as a prophet and all that, I think aren't quite as out of the mainstream as baptizing dead people and so forth.
Elena?
Maybe Flanders and Leonard co-authoring a book together in the future. I don't know. I have to give me a minute to. Pardon? I haven't read that one either, so. I'll let Gary answer.
Sure, there's always room. It's probably going to take some independent person who is really interested in Nauvoo history. And it took how long, Glenn, to do this?
At least
24 years. 24 years. So maybe during the next 24 years, something else will come up. There'll probably be, however, much smaller specialized histories that look at particular developments, like maybe a good history of the origins of plural marriage in Nauvoo. That'd be interesting. Or, you know, maybe the church finally will release the Council of 50 Minutes as part of the Papers of Joseph Smith Project, and that would be, you know, interesting to see that. So political history, that would be my guess anyway for the next 25 years. I don't know of anybody. There's a book coming out by Van Wagner, Van Wagnon, a graduate student on Texas, from one of the Texas University presses, about possible immigration, Mormon immigration into Texas. Yeah, it's that particular, and Glenn does a good job of that too. I mean, that obviously Joseph was very interested in Texas.
We have about 5 more minutes.
Yes.
John C. Bennett has always been a puzzle to me. I think it was William Law in these later years said that Joseph Smith and John C. Bennett deserved each other or something to that effect. But I felt that Joseph Smith was very suspicious of him for